From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Israeli government regards the actions which resulted in the death of Israeli soldiers and the kidnapping of two as a declaration of war by Lebanon on the State of Israel. And we hold the Lebanese government responsible.
Israel's launched the heaviest air bombing of Lebanon in almost a quarter of a century. Beirut Airport was bombed. Bridges and roads were targeted. Israeli ships have entered Lebanese water to block ports. Up to 47 civilians have been killed. The offensive follows the capture of two Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah. We'll go to Beirut to speak with journalist Robert Fisk. Then former Haitian Death Squad leader Emmanuel Toto Constant is arrested in New York.
After living here in New York for more than a decade, Toto Constant has finally been arrested, not for the murder and rape he was responsible for in Haiti, but for grand larceny, forgery, and business record falsification.
Army Specialist Suzanne Swift remains confined to base. She went AWOL when the military did not address her charges of sexual harassment and abuse. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel has launched the heaviest bombing of Lebanon in 24 years. The attack was launched Wednesday following the capture of two soldiers by Hezbollah. Overnight raids across southern Lebanon killed up to 47 civilians, including more than 15 children. At least 100 were wounded, more than 20 bridges targeted in the bombings, causing heavy damage. An Israeli helicopter fired a missile at the headquarters of Hezbollah's Al-Manar TV station in a Beirut suburb, injuring six people, causing damage to the building. Israel's also threatening to attack Beirut's residential neighborhoods. The Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Dan Chalutz, told Haaretz, quote, "Nothing is safe in Lebanon, as simple as that." Israel's imposing an air and sea blockade and has sent ships into Lebanese waters to block ports. The Beirut International Airport has been closed after Israeli rockets targeted its runways. Hezbollah responded by firing volleys of rockets into the northern Israel, killing one Israeli woman and injuring 29. Eight Israeli soldiers were killed, two injured in the Hezbollah operation that nabbed the two soldiers. Israel says it holds the Lebanese government directly responsible. This is Dan Gillerman, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations.
This morning, war has been declared on Israel's northern border. The Israeli government regards the actions which resulted in the death of Israeli soldiers and the kidnapping of two as a declaration of war by Lebanon on the State of Israel. And we hold the Lebanese government responsible.
The Lebanese prime minister has denied any knowledge of the Hezbollah operation and refuses to take responsibility for the two soldiers' capture. Meanwhile, Hezbollah says the soldiers will not be returned without a deal for the release of Palestinian, Lebanese, and other Arab prisoners held in Israeli jails. This is Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah.
There is only one way for these prisoners that we have to go home. Indirect negotiations and prisoner exchange and peace. Nobody in this entire world can take them back home, except through indirect negotiations and exchange. If Israelis think that taking any military action with the purpose of taking back the two prisoners, they are laboring under a great illusion.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan called on Hezbollah to release the soldiers. He also urged all sides to practice restraint and address the targeting of innocent civilians.
Whatever happens in the region, every effort must be taken not to harm civilians. The deliberate attacking and maiming of unarmed civilians is terrorism, pure and simple, whatever the cause.
The bombing of Lebanon has not slowed Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip. Israeli strikes killed at least 23 Palestinians Wednesday. It was the highest single-day Palestinian death toll in nearly 2 years. Earlier today, an Israeli plane bombed the Palestinian Foreign Ministry in Gaza, severely damaging the building and surrounding homes. A Palestinian Foreign Ministry spokesperson said Israel's carrying out organized terrorism. Meanwhile, the death toll in the bombing of a Gaza home early Wednesday rose to at least 18, including a mother and her five children. Five Qassam rockets fired by Palestinians in Gaza landed on Israeli territory, causing no injuries or casualties. In Iraq, at least 30 people were killed and nearly 40 wounded in violence in and around Baghdad Wednesday. 20 Sunni Iraqis were found dead after they were kidnapped from a bus station north of the capital. Hours later, Sunni militants seized 25 people in an attack on a Shiite part of Baghdad. More than 130 people have now been killed in the Baghdad area since Sunday. U.S. General George Casey says he's considering moving more U.S. troops into the capital to respond to the violence. In Mumbai, India, the death toll from Tuesday's train attacks has passed 200. Hundreds more were wounded in the blast, which ripped through commuter trains at the height of rush hour. More than 300 people have been detained in police raids following the attacks. In Afghanistan, the first wave of a new deployment of British troops began arriving in Kabul Wednesday. The British government announced this week it would send an additional 900 troops amid a renewed Western-led offensive in southern Afghanistan. In Mexico, tens of thousands of supporters of presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador marched through Mexico City to demand a recount of the contested presidential election. The marchers convened after setting off from electoral districts around Mexico City. Thousands more are expected to join them as they pour in from districts across Mexico. López Obrador has called on supporters to begin assembling in advance of a major rally this Sunday. In Britain, a top advisor to Prime Minister Tony Blair was arrested Wednesday. The advisor, Lord Levy, is also the leading fundraiser for Blair's Labour Party. Police are investigating whether Labour offered donors state honours in return for million-dollar loans. In other news from Britain, police have confirmed a man found dead in a London park Tuesday was a potential witness in the Enron fraud case. The man, Neil Colbeck, was a former employee of the Royal Bank of Scotland. He'd been interviewed by the FBI about the role of Bank of Scotland's subsidiary NatWest in selling off part of its Enron unit. His death comes as Britain is locked in an internal political struggle over the extradition of three NatWest employees, three bankers, to the United States. The three are being extradited under a treaty critics say is one-sided because the U.S. has yet to ratify it. Meanwhile, in Houston, the former Houston mayor, Bob Lanier, collapsed Wednesday as he attended the memorial service for Enron founder Ken Lay. Former President George Bush, his wife Barbara, and former Secretary of State James Baker were among those in attendance at the Lay memorial service. In Colombia, the Associated Press is reporting President Álvaro Uribe is waging a secret campaign to silence UN human rights monitors who've documented thousands of abuses. Foreign diplomats and rights groups say the government wants to stop the monitors from voicing criticism and publishing their findings. The monitors' investigations have recently forced the Colombian government to arrest more than a dozen soldiers in the killings of nearly 30 civilians, including children and pregnant women. The Colombian government had previously claimed the victims were rebels. The Bush administration has been a key ally of the Uribe government. In March, a letter signed by more than 60 foreign and Colombia rights and development groups urged the White House to back renewing the mandate for Colombian Office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. The Bush administration's refused. And finally, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has weighed in on the Bush administration's controversial plan for intervention in Cuba. The Commission for Assistance to a Free Cuba released a report Monday calling on the U.S. to spend millions of dollars supporting opponents of Fidel Castro.
From here, I say to the North American Empire that instead of thinking about a transition plan for the Cuban Revolution, or for the Venezuelan Revolution, they should be elaborating on a transition plan for themselves, because this century the North American Empire is going to end.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez speaking in Caracas. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! We'll be right back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. A former leader of a Haitian death squad who now lives in New York was arrested last week for taking part in mortgage fraud. During the early 1990s, Emmanuel Toto Constant led the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti, or FRAP. Human rights groups estimate FRAP killed thousands of supporters of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. Constant has since admitted he was on the payroll of the CIA and has lived in New York for the last decade. In November of 2000, Constant was convicted in absentia by a Haitian high court for his involvement in the 1994 Raboteau massacre. 2 years ago, he was sued in federal court on behalf of three women who said his soldiers beat and gang-raped women in Haiti.
Despite a deportation order, Constant has been allowed to stay in the United States since he threatened to reveal the extent of his ties with the CIA and DIA, first exposed by Alan Nairn in The Nation magazine. On Friday, a judge set bail at $50,000 over the protests of prosecutors and human rights groups. Attorney General Elliot Spitzer's office said Constant and five others defrauded banks out of more than $1 million in loans. We're joined in our Firehouse studio now by Ray LaForest, longtime Haitian community organizer and activist. We're also joined by Kim Ives, who is formerly the editor of the Haitian newspaper Haiti Progrès. He attended Constant's arraignment in Riverhead. Let's start with you, Kim, the arraignment. What happened?
Well, it was a real pleasure, Amy, to see Toto Constant in green prison drab and with his hands handcuffed behind his back. Here is a guy who was responsible for the killing and rape and terrorization of the Haitian population during much of the early 90s. And he was subdued. Attorney General tried to get a bail of $2 million on him as a flight risk, which certainly he would try to do. But the judge finally put out $50,000 cash, so we'll see if he makes that.
And he met it, didn't he? Isn't he out?
Not that I know, unless that's something that happened yesterday.
And the charges specifically in terms of the fraud allegations, what do they involve?
What they did, he was part of a group of six people which were selling houses falsely. He would find the straw buyers for houses. And this is just one of what the Deputy Attorney General told me was dozens that they have in the pipeline. This was one scheme where they would sell a house. The money that the bank would give for the mortgage would essentially be divvied up between the circle of people, and he was part of this ring.
So that's the crime he's allegedly guilty of. We'll see. He'd have to be tried. Ray LaForest, your response to his arrest, but not for command responsibility for the deaths of perhaps thousands in Haiti during the first coup against Aristide, 91 to 94, one that certainly affected your family.
Yes. Well, first, we're not surprised. This is a man who grew up in a world of immorality of the Duvalier regime and whose father was a general, quote-unquote, in the Haitian army, and who's used to abusing people and not respecting this any legality. So we're not surprised at all. And as you implied here, this is ironic that a man who is guilty of genocide against the Haitian people is arrested for relatively minor offense, although I understand that we're talking about $1 million and more. And so although as Kim, we rejoice to see some modicum of justice, our hearts are still heavy because the burden imposed on the Haitian people has been tremendous and continues to be so. So for us, it's one chapter. It's an important one because he's the most hated individual in Haiti since Papa Doc, probably. And somebody has done much to earn that despise from the Haitian people and others.
Now, you have been in the forefront for years now of leading protests against the presence of Constant here in the United States. You've even led pickets of his office and his home in Queens. Could you talk a little bit about this whole situation with him, already been convicted in Haiti for crimes, but yet walking the streets freely here in New York for so long?
Well, first, I want to make clear that these efforts were never individual efforts. They've always been collective efforts on the part of the Haitian community. We consider them extremely important. If you watch what happened as the Haitian people struggled for self-empowerment in the years preceding Aristide's arrival as president, one of the, as poor as the conditions were in Haiti, the Haitian people always insisted on justice and respect. And for us to move forward, we could not tolerate the presence of such an individual in our midst. We knew that once people started denouncing his presence in the early 1990s, once he left Haiti, he was arrested and he pretty much blackmailed the U.S. government by starting to reveal information. As Amy said, Alan Nair did an amazing job making connection with the CIA. So we initiated the first demonstration against him at 26 Federal Plaza, not far from here, the INS Immigration Headquarters in New York, where he reported every Tuesday. So we felt that we had to bring the message to him directly, and not only to let his neighbors know who this Haitian Dr. Mengele was in the midst, and give him and others who do crimes like him the message clearly that we will not accept. That is the price to pay for this kind of a crime.
Can you talk about the lawsuit, Kim Ives, that was brought against Emmanuel Constant on behalf of three unnamed women, Jane Doe 1, 2, and 3, raped in Haiti?
The Center for Justice and Accountability in San Francisco did a good job in getting together, finally, three women who will testify anonymously about his role in organizing these gangs, which, among other things, raped women. This was part of the terrorization campaign. There was, a few years ago, a case which was championed by the Center for Constitutional Rights of Alert Balance, who was also hacked to death, or almost to death, left for dead in a mass graveyard, and managed to drag herself to the road and get back here to the state, get back to the States, where she brought a suit as well. So this is the latest, and in fact, Moira Feeney over at CGA was working with the prosecutors here in New York State to track down Constant and follow some of his real estate shenanigans.
In one of the news accounts of his arraignment, there's an indication now that the immigration authorities say that there's an outstanding deportation order against him that they may try to implement. And I'm wondering, if there was a deportation order, why didn't they try to implement it before? And if they're going to implement it now, are they going to deport him to Haiti, or are they going to basically use that as an excuse to get him out of the country again?
Well, we have to remember that the timeline as it went was that Constant left Haiti on Christmas Eve 94, came to the States. For 5 months, he was hiding in plain sight. Finally, the U.S. government felt themselves embarrassed enough to arrest him. This was under Clinton, and he was in jail for 11 months, from May 95 to June 96. In 96, there was a deal cut, which we broke at Haiti Progress, which was basically between CIA, State Department, Justice, to let him out if he kept his nose out of trouble and he didn't talk to the press and didn't do anything, because he had gone to 60 Minutes on December of 95 and said he worked for the CIA, admitted that he was getting paid $700 a month. So after that, he was put on ice, they thought, but he kept getting in trouble and he kept talking to the press. So I think at this point, he's kind of a liability for them. And I don't know if they'll cut him loose, so to speak. I mean, he's facing 25 years if convicted on these charges, after which time, under the new immigration laws, he would automatically be deported.
Ray LaForest, in a piece in the New York Times about the whole Constant case, it says that his lawyer, Edward Palermo of Smithtown, Long Island, said Constant's pleading not guilty to the financial charges, but added he knew little of his client's past in Haiti or his immigration status. The lawyer said, "They want to make my client's political past in Haiti the background of the case for publicity and to prejudice the judge to set a high bail, when it really has nothing to do with these charges." Your response?
Well, lawyers will decide in this country what the relevance is. But for us, it's a continuation of a behavior that requires attention. As Kim just said, this guy was hiding in plain sight. I remember as we were fighting immigration deportation against Haitians, when people who were forced to leave Haiti as a result of FRAP's action were being pursued by the INS, when this individual was sitting here without any consequences. So for us, we believe that the whole package should be analyzed at once, and that he should be considered an undesirable individual in the midst of the community of Queens.
What would happen if he was deported to Haiti? It's quite something that this happens not during the reign of the U.S.-backed leader who was installed after Aristide was forced out in the U.S.-backed coup, but is now here under René Préval, the new president who was president after Aristide the first time. What do you think would happen?
Well, he's already been convicted in the year 2000 for his role in helping to organize the massacre in Rabateau in April 1994.
In which what happened?
In which dozens of people were gunned down by FRAP and the Haitian military as they were protesting and fleeing. Some were shot in the sea. It was a terrible, terrible massacre. And he was one of many who were found guilty in absentia. It's for sure that he should be arrested. If the Préval government has the courage and capacity to do that remains another question. But he certainly should be, and there would be no doubt that the population would want to see him in jail.
And Ray, your sense of the impact of this arrest in Haiti, and Haiti for the most part, since Préval came in as president again, has dropped out of the mass media of the United States as an issue or a concern. But your sense of the impact on the continuing battle for popular democracy in Haiti?
Unfortunately, many of the victims of FRAP and Toto Constant are not around to appreciate what's going on. Arlette Bellas, as horrendous as her wounds were, still was lucky enough to be alive and testify that this was taking place in Haiti. But for us, it is clearly justice has to be met. We have to build a new society based on a new beginning. And some attitudes, we have to create a system where these things are no longer possible. And besides the organizing and of Haitian masses, clearly this kind of justice has to be met. And as Kim said, I'm not sure. There's an outstanding warrant from the Haitian government for his extradition. And we would hope that the Haitian government would exercise that option and ask that to do. This is a highly symbolic action that would indicate that we're putting the elements together into moving forward.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Ray LaForest is a longtime Haitian community activist, lives here in New York City, and Kim Ives is the former editor of the Haitian newspaper Haiti Progrès and a producer at WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you.
Haitian song, What a Plot, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to the case of Suzanne Swift.
She's the Army specialist who has been arrested and confined to base for going AWOL after her charges of sexual harassment and assault went unaddressed by the military. Swift served in Iraq for a year, but decided she could not return and went AWOL. She said her superiors repeatedly sexually harassed her while she was serving in Iraq. On June 11th, the Eugene police knocked on her mother's front door, and Suzanne was arrested and taken to the county jail. She has since been transferred to Fort Lewis, where she is confined to her base. So far, no charges have been filed against her, and Fort Lewis officials have said they will assign an independent investigator to look into her charges of sexual harassment.
Suzanne Swift turns 22 on Saturday. Her family and supporters are urging a national day of action on her behalf and behalf of women around the country. A Meet Me in Fort Lewis rally and vigil are planned for noon outside the Fort Lewis base in Washington State. Another in her hometown of Eugene, Oregon, is planned for noon at the Federal Building. A few days ago, I went to Eugene, Oregon, to the Oregon Country Fair, and I interviewed Suzanne Swift's mother, Sarah Rich. We played that interview earlier this week. Today, we bring you Suzanne Swift's grandfather, Jim Rich. I spoke with him at the country fair. I asked him how he felt when Suzanne first joined the Army.
I was very sorry when she succumbed to the blandishments of a very smooth-tongued recruiter. And I thought when she decided not to go back, she had made the best possible decision, considering the things that she'd gone through, things that no male soldier would ever, ever, ever in his wildest dreams have to endure. I hope that justice is served. I hope that light is shone on this aspect of the Army that makes women recruits the prey of sexual predators, and that Suzanne is honorably discharged. I also hope that the rest of our soldiers get to come home soon and no more sent.
That's Jim Rich, Suzanne Swift's grandfather. He's also a blacksmith at the and he was at the Oregon Country Fair and made the iron tools for the new film Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, we're joined on the phone right now by Susan Avila Smith. She's a military sexual trauma specialist, founder and director of Women Organizing Women, an advocacy group for survivors of rape in the military. We invited a representative from Fort Lewis Military Base, where Suzanne is confined, to be on our program, but they declined our request. Susan Avila Smith, thanks so much for being with us. I realize it's tough for you to come out of your recovering from cancer, and yet you have chosen to take the time to stand up for Suzanne. Why?
Oh, good morning. Well, I think it's an extremely important problem going on in the military right now, and they continue to keep sweeping this under the rug. Congress has done multiple investigations, but they have made no changes to any of the accountability within the military, and it's really time that somebody stands up, and the fact that Suzanne stood up and went AWOL is showing how bad the problem is.
And you had an opportunity to meet with her, and in terms of her experiences, how they compare to others that that your organization has dealt with in recent years?
The experience that she's had has been similar to the 600 other cases that I've had. It's usually a command rape. It's usually covered up. It's usually that they try to persecute the victim rather than persecute the perpetrators.
And have there been any instances where actual rapes or assaults have been prosecuted by the military?
Yeah, there's been a few, usually the high-profile cases, and sometimes, you know, justice is done. There's been a 30-year sentence. But generally speaking, of the hundreds and thousands, there's probably 100,000 women who have been raped over the lifetime of women in the service. Generally speaking, no. The perpetrator usually is running free, and the victim is usually kicked out of the military.
Susan, can you tell us your own story, how you got involved with helping women in the military?
when I was in, I experienced some domestic violence and sexual assault, and both times it was dismissed by the military. When I finally got out, I was working, or I was in a women's support group at the Seattle VA, and found out that so many women had been raped in the military, and nobody really knew what to do. And the paperwork to file claims with the VA was impossible for anybody with post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we got together and started helping other women with the paperwork, and it evolved into helping other women nationwide with claims as old as from World War II. And now I'm doing a lot of active duty cases.
In Suzanne Swift's case, apparently she was asked to fill out a 700-question psychological questionnaire. It seems to me quite extreme in the situation that she was under. Do you have similar instances where those who have come forth have been, the target then has been on them and on their psychological situation?
Yeah, that was also the same with the Sergeant Audra Wood. I think it's very typical of the military to do an MMPI on the soldiers. Unfortunately, they're doing it on the victims rather than the perpetrators, but it also, it does help to find a baseline to see if there is damage to the victim and to see if there's mental health counseling that needs to be taken care of and addressed.
In the case of Suzanne Swift, and we've talked to her mother several times, she says that when she was in Iraq and she got into a vehicle with a sergeant, he immediately talked about having sex with her. Even back at Fort Lewis at the base, when she showed up and asked where she should report for duty, she said another sergeant said, "In my bed, naked." Right before July 4th weekend at the big formation where hundreds of soldiers are there, the person in charge said he wanted 21-year-olds to step forward to tell them, you know, they shouldn't be drinking on July 4th weekend. And then he said, "Anyone who has gone AWOL in the last 6 months, I want to step forward." And, of course, Suzanne was the only one to step forward. Then she was also that week earlier taken for the psych evaluation without telling her mother, without telling her attorney, taken alone until her mother raised such a fuss. She was taken back from the psych testing area, though she had to take it the next week. What about the response of the military in all these cases, and her saying she even went to her EO officer in Iraq, equal opportunity, to complain about harassment, and the message that was sent when he did nothing about it?
Well, she has followed the chain of command, or attempted to follow the chain of command, which has failed her. And they have reprimanded the first sergeant who singled her out at formation. And I don't believe that that's going to be happening again. She's currently with a new command who has been sensitive to her needs and is acting, what I believe, above and beyond what a normal military command would do. They recognize that this is a high-profile case, and they seem to be now doing the right things for her.
And also the issue of the impact of war itself on these situations. Are you finding that the number of victims is greater in war situations like in Iraq or Afghanistan than it is in peacetime efforts of the military?
It's a little bit more during the war, but I think maybe perhaps people are reporting a little bit more. It continues to go on stateside, continues to go on overseas at other bases. Generally speaking, the concept of sexual assault in the military is handled the same and is the same on every single base.
Finally, Susan Avila-Smith, you're well known in the Puget Sound area as an advocate for sexually assaulted military veterans. Have been working very hard on this. Again, you've been going through radiation, and you're quoted in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer saying, "Cancer is curable, PTSD is not."
Well, coming to terms with having my own PTSD has taken about a decade to learned to manage my symptoms rather than my symptoms managing me. I'm lucky that I'm a highly functional person with PTSD because I sought treatment very early on after I was diagnosed. And as a result, my level of functioning is good, and that's my hope for Suzanne, is that she gets out and she's able to get the treatment that she needs so that she can deal with this. As far as my cancer goes, it's a bump in the road. It's kind of unfortunate because I'm not able to help the number of women that need help. But I'm not looking at this as a life-threatening illness or something that's going to be continuing to linger like my PTSD.
Susan Avila-Smith, we want to thank you very much for joining us, founder and director of Women Organizing Women, an advocacy group for survivors of rape in the military. Again, protests are planned for Eugene and outside Fort Lewis. Meet me in Fort Lewis in Washington State for Suzanne on her birthday on Saturday. And her mother says, for all women in the military, to protect them. The website, SuzanneSwift.org. The email address is for my daughter, Suzanne, at yahoo.com. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we move on to our next story, Juan.
We now look at a largely covert aspect of the Bush administration's war on terror, the government's aggressive pursuit of Muslim informants. This week, the Wall Street Journal ran an article titled, A Muslim's Choice, Turn U.S. Informant or Risk Losing Visa. The report detailed the case of Yassin Youssef. Last November, Yassin's green card was taken away from him when he crossed the border into Canada. Yassin was then sent home to San Francisco and told to contact a counterterrorism agent at the FBI. The article states that the agent, quote, made him an offer, become an informant and regularly report to the FBI on what his Muslim friends in San Francisco were saying and doing. In exchange, he would get back his green card. According to Yassin, if he refused, the agent threatened to deport him back to Morocco.
We're joined in our D.C. studio by Benafsha Eklagi. She's an attorney for Yassin Youssef. Benafsha is also the founder and president of the National Legal Sanctuary for Community Advancement, a group working to protect the civil rights of people from the Middle East, have Middle East backgrounds, Muslims, South Asians. We did invite a spokesperson from the FBI to be on our program today, but they declined our request. Benafsha Eklagi, tell us more about your client.
Good morning, Amy. Yes, Yassin Youssef entered my office at the latter part of last year. And when he entered, he was placed in what's called deferred inspections. So he wasn't yet placed in deportation proceedings and removal proceedings. And deferred inspections is this quasi-administrative aspect, functionality of the immigration system. Well, he had an appointment. We entered the facility at 630 Sansom in San Francisco, California, for that appointment. When we were waiting to be seen on the issue of having his green card being taken away from him, and he had received his green card, I should say, through the lottery system. And when we were waiting to be seen, we noticed that the FBI agent that Yassin had met with in Oakland at the Bay Area Rapid Transportation System. It's a location where he and the FBI agent had been basically moving around, walking around the BART station for some hour and a half to 2 hours while the FBI agent was attempting to have Yassin agree to become an informant for the FBI. That FBI agent, along with another gentleman with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, entered the same floor and they asked me to come in first. And they explained to me that they were going to, out of respect and out of not protocol, definitely not out of protocol, allow me to sit in with the investigation and the interview in representation of my client. But they were also quite clear in stating that I shouldn't speak too much and that if I had gotten in the way of their investigations, that they could ask me to leave.
Now, when they first confronted him, the FBI agents apparently told him that they had been monitoring him and some of his friends for quite some time.
Do you have any information now about what kind of surveillance was being done even before they approached him?
You know, once we received the green card back months later, what I was told by the Department of Homeland Security's attorney was that there were transcripts, and the transcripts were finally unclassified, declassified, and that he had a moment to be able to glance at those transcripts. Now, I haven't actually been able to access the transcripts myself, but allegedly what has appeared in those transcripts are communications between Yassin and his friends. One individual in particular, according to the attorney for the Department of Homeland Security, was not truly a friend, but an informant as well for the FBI. And that in those communications that there was some political speech and viewpoint by Yassin and his friends and his colleagues that would have been and are protected by the First Amendment as free speech, political speech. But in this case, it had risen to the level of suspicion and the level of investigation. Now, in terms of how heightened that level was, they didn't have enough. The government didn't have enough in terms of evidence to be able to place Yassin in removal proceedings. In fact, what was stated by the Department of Homeland Security's attorneys was, go and find evidence before I can proceed. We can proceed on deportation claims. So for several months, 5 months, we were waiting for what was called future possible evidence to come through. And in the meantime, Yassin's life was literally placed on hold.
The FBI refused to come on, but they did send a statement from Special Agent, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right, LaRue Key, Q-U-Y, spokesperson for the FBI in Northern California, who said, the FBI did not arbitrarily choose Mr. Yousef from a group of young Muslim men. The FBI was in receipt of specific information that indicated Mr. Yousef was either directly involved in or had knowledge of terrorist-related activities. After conversations with Mr. Yousef and further investigation, our concerns about Mr. Yousef have considerably diminished. That, the spokesperson for the FBI. Your response, Banafsha Eklagi.
You know, the course of action is really the issue. The way in which the FBI decided to really just target this individual. I mean, let's be very clear on what occurred. My client went back to Casablanca, Morocco, where he's a native of, to visit his family. Through the Charles de Gaulle Airport in France, he boarded a plane and was heading towards San Francisco. 3 hours en route, the pilot comes onto the intercom and states that there's a security breach on that flight. My client, along with the rest of the passengers on that flight, became quite distressed and distraught. They turn the flight back around. They land. Two officials, French officials, board the plane and approach my client. And it's at that point that Yassin discovers that he is the security breach. And from there, he has to purchase his own ticket back to Casablanca, where, again, he's handed over to the officials, the Moroccan officials. And he is investigated and questioned there for over a month. And during the course of the investigations and the questioning and interrogations, he's literally told that the United States government wants for his cooperation. He really, truly believes that they have the wrong name, the wrong individual. So he attempts to come back into the United States through Montreal, Canada, so that he can access the government here and try to figure out exactly where the problem was. Now, when he enters back through New York, the FBI come and visit him, and they give him a card, and they say the FBI agent in San Francisco is awaiting his response.
We just have 30 seconds, Banafsha.
The issue is, if you are looking for terrorists, if you are looking for national security threats, these are not the mechanisms and the ways to do it. Because if Yassin was truly a threat, back within the community, these types of evidence are being collected. And individuals, if they had a negative thought about the United States, based on these actions, can truly start to look at ways to be able to harm us. Yassin is not one of those individuals.
We want to thank you very much for being with us. Binafsha Khalaghi is the attorney for Yassin Yousef. In the Wall Street Journal piece by Peter Waldman, Muslim's Choice, Turn U.S. Informant or Risk Losing Visa, it ends with a quote of Mr. Yousef. He says, "It's okay to ask me or anyone else if you see a dangerous person, an extremist. Will you call us?" He says, "Of course I will, but I don't want to live a secret life." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Gaza. Stay with us. Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Israel has launched its heaviest bombing of Lebanon in 24 years. Three Israeli rockets hit runways at Beirut Airport, forcing the closure of the country's only international airport. Israeli ships have entered Lebanese water to block ports. More than 20 bridges were targeted, causing heavy damage. And an Israeli helicopter fired a missile at the headquarters of Hezbollah's Al-Manar TV station in a Beirut suburb. Overnight raids across southern Lebanon killed up to 47 civilians, including more than 15 children, and wounded over 100 people. Israeli Army Chief of Staff Dan Halutz told Haaretz, quote, "Nothing is safe in Lebanon, as simple as that." The major offensive follows the capture of two Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah. Hezbollah militants responded by firing volleys of rockets into northern Israel, killing one Israeli woman and injuring 29.
Eight Israeli soldiers were killed, two injured in the Hezbollah operation that nabbed the two soldiers. Israel said it holds Lebanon responsible for the soldiers' capture and views it as an act of war. Hezbollah says they'll not return them until or without a release deal for Palestinian, Lebanese, and other Arab prisoners held in Israeli jails. The Lebanese prime minister has denied any knowledge of Hezbollah operation and refused to take responsibility for the soldiers' capture. The Israeli offensive comes as Israel continues a separate attack in the Gaza Strip over another captured soldier. In Gaza, Israeli jets attacked the Palestinian Foreign Ministry building in Gaza City, injuring at least 10 people. At least 23 Palestinian civilians have died in 24 hours, including nine in one family whose Gaza City home was bombed. We're joined on the phone right now by Nasir Arouri, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, author of the book Dishonest Broker, America's Role in Israel and Palestine. And on the phone with us from Tel Aviv, we're joined by Uri Avneri, a well-known Israeli peace activist. Nasir Arouri, your response to what's happening both in Gaza and now in Lebanon.
Well, I think we can take the two situations as actually as an opportunity, I think, for Israel to reshape the strategic landscape in the region. I think that the Israeli invasion of Gaza and the incursion into Lebanon, which you just described very well, are conceivably the product of the same strategic goals, and I would mention two main goals. One is to forestall a diplomatic solution based on two states, for which Hamas has been more than ready. I think Hamas has really been on record since it was elected in interviews with the Israeli press that it is ready to accept a two-state solution. If that was not given explicitly, certainly it was made implicit. And 2 days ago, Ismail Haniyeh, the prime minister from Hamas, launched a peace offensive in an op-ed in the Washington Post. So it was made really very clear. And it seems that whenever Israel is threatened with a ceasefire or a peace offensive, it bombs its way out of a diplomatic settlement. I mean, the question of Hamas not accepting Israel is certainly not a valid one. So this is the first strategic goal that Israel would hope to realize. And the second one, I think, is to try to realize objectives that are remain unfulfilled since the 82 invasion, and made worse since 2000, since Israel withdrew from Lebanon. What I have in mind is that in 1982, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon carried three major objectives. One is to foreclose on the option of a Palestinian state, because I think the PLO came to be seen in Lebanon as a state in formation, a state in waiting. That's one. The second objective of 1982 was to redraw the map, the political map of Lebanon, in such a way that it would bring the right-wing phalange, Israel's allies, into power. And the third one is to reduce Syria's influence to manageable proportions. Well, if we look at the situation now, we find that only the first one was realized, not really realized, I should say, postponed. And that is the foreclosure on the option of a Palestinian state. It is still a state in waiting. So Israel calculates now that it has a chance, an opportunity, to reshape the strategic landscape and to realize objectives that remain there, pending, but not realized.
Nasser Ariri, I wanted to bring in Uri Avneri, a well-known Israeli peace activist, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. Your response to the situation right now, extremely dire. Israel saying that the capture of the Israeli soldiers is an act of war.
Well, there are two questions. One is what will happen to the three Israeli soldiers captured in Gaza and on the Lebanese borders. And we believe, my friends and I believe, that the solution to that is to exchange prisoners. We've done this before. It should be done now. And we are very much against the statement of our prime minister that he will not even consider exchange of prisoners. I think this statement really puts the life of the prisoners in jeopardy. But beyond that, this whole war is something which I think is very detrimental to the chances of peace. We are going to have in 2 hours from now, we are going to have a demonstration in front of the Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv protesting against the war. The question is, what is the real aim of this war in Lebanon? It's we know the aim of the war in Gaza. It is to destroy the elected Palestinian government led by Hamas, because our government considers Hamas a terrorist organization. Unfortunately, it's helped by this by the United States, which is very active to stop any transfer of money to the elected Palestinian government. In Lebanon, I believe that the real aim is to destroy the accumulation of rockets by the Hezbollah army. They have been accumulating rockets, all kinds of rockets, for a long time. They have been, by now they should have thousands of rockets, including rockets which could reach major Israeli cities. And I believe that our army, which is now led by the Air Force, the chief of staff of our army is an Air Force officer, And the aim is to destroy, to use our air force to destroy these rockets in southern Lebanon, even at the risk of major Israeli cities being hit in the exchange of fire.
But Uri Avneri, when we see situations where reports of Israel bombing bridges, attacking the airport in Beirut, this seems to be far more than just going after an arms cache. This seems to be, and I'm wondering whether the Israeli population, having already gone through decades of the situation of the previous occupation of Lebanon, how people can countenance sort of a reopening of hostilities in Lebanon.
This operation is not similar to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. It is rather similar to the Israeli action in 1996 when Shimon Peres, who was then the prime minister, attacked South Lebanon with the idea of terrorizing the population there into fleeing, evacuating South Lebanon altogether. The idea is that if we exert enough pressure on the Lebanese population, the general population in Lebanon, then the population will pressure the Lebanese government, and the Lebanese government will pressure the Hezbollah, and so on.
I wanted to give Nasser Arouri the last word. Israeli newspaper Haaretz is quoting Israeli military officials as warning Lebanon's clock will be turned back 20 years unless the soldiers are returned. We have 10 seconds. Your response.
Well, this is certainly very ominous, and it shows that what I said before about reshaping the strategic landscape. I mean, I think that Israel calculates now that its position since 2002 has really diminished. They look at Hezbollah, it's becoming a respectable political actor, part of the government. The Cedar Revolution in Lebanon seems to have fizzled. Syria hasn't been undermined. Iran is on the rise at the regional level. Hamas, like Hezbollah, has also become a major political actor, receiving a majority of votes. And the U.S. is bogged down in Iraq.
Professor Nasser Arouri, we're going to have to leave it there. And I want to thank you for being with us, as well as Uri Avneri in Tel Aviv. We're sorry we could not reach Robert Fisk in Lebanon. We'll try again tomorrow. That does it for today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, and Aaron Maté. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.